It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out how to right the balance on U.S. diplomacy. But first, with a budget deal locked down for the year and some upward-looking economic indicators, what should we expect next from the U.S. economy?
Here to help us get a handle on what might be coming soon to an economy near you is Robin Farzad. He's a senior writer for Bloomberg Businessweek. Robin, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Wisconsin.
Well, Americans have been waiting and waiting for things to turn around when it comes to the U.S. economy. And lately we've seen some strong economic indicators seem to be pointing in the right direction. So is it safe to say we're out of the woods?
No, it's really a tale of two economies. If you're in New York and Wall Street is having really its best year in almost a decade, and IPOs are great, and junk bonds, you can't sell enough of them, and there's all this enthusiasm about tech stocks, and there's this sense of buoyancy in corporate America. But back in Main Street, people are still unemployed. They're underemployed. You have a record number of 20-somethings still living with their parents, a backlog of people who can't get jobs out of college. And you just haven't seen this kind of bifurcation in a long time.
What do you make of it? What do you think it's coming from?
There's an odd disconnect in that typically when Wall Street and companies see their share prices and their fortunes this high, they would turn around and say, we can't leave money on the table. We have to turn around and hire people. There's a return on investment implicitly implied, I think, in bringing people on. But they have for the longest time just hoarded cash, have allowed their cash flow and their cash balances and their profits to stockpile, and they've learned to do more with less. At the same time, there's been a tremendous amount of offshoring, and there's so much slack in the economy that companies and small businesses realize that they have the clout. They can name their price in terms of wages. There are people with tons of experience who are willing to work on part-time terms or for less than what they've traditionally made. So that imbalance is still very pronounced in the economy.
Well, the Fed seems to think that things are looking good. They've said that they're going to start withdrawing more and more. At least they're going to stop. They're going to scale back the cash infusions to the economy. So, what does that mean when we're seeing less Fed interference?
Well, less Fed interference. I mean, it's a relative observation if you think about it, because we're still at zero interest rate policy, and we've been at zero interest rate policy since December of 2008. That is the main lever of stimulus that the Federal Reserve controls, but when that wasn't enough to take rates down to zero, they came out with quantitative easing, which was just conjuring up rounds and rounds of trillions of dollars to buy up assets such as mortgage securities and treasuries to keep them low so people can go out and refinance and companies can partake in record low borrowing costs. We're just talking about the Fed taking $10 billion a month off the table. Nothing about finally taking rates up or ending quantitative easing. So this goes to show how tender the economy is and how the Fed is really walking on eggshells to be careful to not spook anybody. After all, when Ben Bernanke gave some testimony in the spring and merely mentioned the possibility of a taper, you saw markets have what's now called a taper tantrum in the summer. And so the Fed's being very cautious, especially as Mr. Bernanke is going to be handing off the torch to Janet Yellen.
So we have a new budget deal. Does that mean, you know, there's going to be a stabilizing influence on the economy, maybe good news, or what do you expect from that?
I think investors at least have learned to tune out the histrionics from Capitol Hill, whether you're talking about the fiscal cliff or the budgetary butte or the cash flow cliff or whatever you want to call it this year. And there are these man-made deadlines that come every December or January after we really punted on what was a very necessary deal when our credit rating was downgraded in 2011. The key thing to note here is what Congress is passing is still contractionary. This is not a stimulative budget by any stretch. The Fed is being stimulative still. It still has a campaign of something like $75 billion a month of quantitative easing in addition to zero interest rate policy. Congress is not out there cutting tax rebate checks to people at this point, and there's no unanimity over which way it should go. So in many respects, Pennsylvania Avenue has kind of ceded economic control to the Federal Reserve.
Well, so as you sit at your desk and you look at all the portents and think about what 2014 might hold, what does it look like to you?
Well, I hope, you know, and this is the patriot in me and the small-time investor and a person who has parents who have not been as gainfully employed as they could be. I hope that this finally trickles down or recourses to the rest of the economy. It's been so great for creditworthy companies, for junk issuers, for Wall Street firms. You would hope that there'd be a tipping point where some of this excess liquidity and this feeling of having a lot of cash and 2008 and 2007 being increasingly a distant memory, you would hope that would spread more to middle America and Main Street. And hopefully that could happen. We've seen stranger things in the past, obviously with the recession of the early 90s. If you go back and just read some of the things that were written in Time Magazine or Business Week back then, this was the biggest economic calamity in a generation. It was really bad and we didn't know what would get us out of it. And suddenly out of the blue comes something called Netscape and the internet, and suddenly it changed the conversation. And maybe something like that will happen here. People in the United States talk about the energy renaissance and North Dakota now being bigger than the smallest member of OPEC, and that could bring down costs for manufacturers. There's increasing evidence of onshoring, of companies bringing jobs back to the United States. So we'll see. Maybe you can expect the unexpected.
Is that the kind of thing we need to see for economic improvement before we can plant that mission accomplished flag in the ground?
Oh, gosh, mission accomplished. We're still in Iraq and Afghanissan. I don't know. How many other missions are there to accomplish?
Maybe we shouldn't be using that word, right?
Oh, gosh, no. That's a very dangerous thing to say. And no one is really running victory laps in D.C. If you remember the Clinton presidency, he and Al Gore would almost daily in the old executive office building have some sort of event that highlighted how well the economy was doing. It was this very rare confluence of Wall Street being flush, middle America being flush. There was an investor class. You know, you started this segment by talking about the Dow at another record, and people almost roll their eyes when they say it. How many records has the market hit this year? And it's not affecting individual investors, people who have disproportionately been out of the market. They're still repairing their personal balance sheets after the trauma of 2008, which was like a once-in-a-generation trauma. So there's a lot to repair.
Now, I want to ask you about an idea out there that's gotten a little bit of play. It's bouncing around on the internet, in the media. There have been some doomsdayers out there that have been getting a little attention, among them Donald Trump, CEO Peter Schiff, the Swiss economist Mark Faber. And they're basically saying, you know, we're all doomed, economically speaking. What we're in now is the calm before the storm. And the economy is poised to tank as never before, protect your wealth, all that kind of thing. What do you make of that?
Well, they say that a broken clock is right at least twice a day. And I think that's the case with some of the people that you mentioned. I mean, Peter Schiff, I like his stuff. He's delightfully shrill. He will come out and find a gray cloud for every silver lining. And you look back at the subprime crisis, and there were troubadours. There were people who effectively predicted stuff like this, like Nouriel Roubini and Nassim Nicholas Taleb. But by and large, the U.S. economy is hugely resilient, and 9 out of 10 times it will prove the doomsayers wrong. And there are people out there that make a living hoarding gold and warning of the apocalypse and building greenhouses way up in the mountains and in the countryside. And, you know, let them do what they want to do. They're very often incorrect.
So given that, would you say that 2013 has been a good year economically for President Obama?
It has been. He got elected. He got reelected with a mandate. But the problem is that no one is really banking clout off of this. It's not like he could have parlayed what happened to him in 2012 and turned around and stuck it to the GOP on Capitol Hill. This is still an economy where individuals, mom and pop, small businesses are not feeling their oats as much as Wall Street and huge corporations are.
Robin, thank you so much for joining us, and happy holidays.
Always a pleasure. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Robin Farzad, senior writer for Bloomberg Businessweek.
This is Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The United States spends far more on its military than any other country in the world, more than the next 10 countries combined, in fact. And in recent history, leaders and policymakers have suggested that the U.S. may be underusing its diplomacy.
Johns Hopkins professor and Middle East Institute scholar Daniel Serwer makes that argument in his most recent book, Righting the Balance, How You Can Help Protect America. In the book, he proposes diplomacy as a cheaper and more effective solution to solving some of the world's problems. Daniel has spent his career on diplomatic missions around the world, and he joins us now. Professor Serwer, welcome back to Central Time.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Now, you say that we're all born diplomats. What do you mean by that?
we all try to get the best deal for ourselves, and that's what diplomats try to do for the country.
And in writing the balance, you say that we need to do more of that and less military then. Is that the case?
Well, I think we need to combine the two arms that we have. We have a very strong military arm, and we've got a rather weak diplomatic arm. And both would be stronger if they were used more effectively together rather than trying to rely on one or the other separately.
Now, have we always had that imbalance between military and diplomacy in the U.S. and how we approach the world?
My belief that we have. I tried to find the origins of this imbalance, and I got back to the French and Indian War, and I decided not to go any farther. The United States, we think of ourselves as a peaceful country, but in fact we've been at war for about a quarter of the years that the Republic has existed, and that doesn't count wars against pirates and against American Indians, which of course were very common in the 19th century. So ours is not an entirely peaceful nation, maybe a peace-loving nation, but it's not an entirely peaceful nation, and this imbalance has existed for a long time.
But you're suggesting that it's even worse now than it was before?
I think what's happened is that our military arm has reached the point of diminishing returns. So that as we spend extra dollars on the military, we can buy very little improved performance. And I think we have much more room for improvement for every dollar on the diplomatic side. Not that I'm asking us to spend more on the diplomatic side. In fact, quite to the contrary, I've suggested a major institutional reorganization that would free up money on the diplomatic side and enable us to continue within current budget limits.
Now, can we see, is part of the reason for the whole diplomacy, the less diplomacy, is because the U.S. has a slightly different standing in the world than it used to be? I mean, you know, back in the old days, was it easier for the United States to be a diplomat than it is now?
Well, I don't know if that's really the case. I think what happened was that we got our way in the world. We found it very effective to strengthen our military arm. We projected power farther and farther, and we found it a very effective way to deal with the rest of the world, and it, in some respects, remains that. The problem is that everybody else is looking at us and saying, look, we're not going to challenge you militarily. Mm-hmm. They're challenging us now on the economic front. They're challenging us on the diplomatic front because they see very clearly that our strength on the military front is much greater than theirs. So I don't expect rivals, adversaries, enemies to challenge us militarily for the next 20 years, more than likely. The only real military challenges on the horizon are if we decide that we don't want Iran to get nuclear weapons and need to use military means to prevent it, or if China decides 20 years from now to challenge us militarily. But there are many more challenges in the world today than that, and most of them are better dealt with by civilian means rather than military means.
Is it more difficult to do that, though, when you're thought of as leading with your military force rather than your diplomatic force?
Well, yes, and it's more difficult to do that if you are so practiced on the military side and so poorly practiced on the civilian side. There are countries in this world that punch way above their weight in diplomacy. I think of Norway. I think of Sweden. I'd like to see the United States punching above its weight on the diplomatic side. That would be a world that in which we'd have to spend a lot less and in which we'd be much more effective than we are today.
You keep talking about spending a lot less. What are we wasting money on in the diplomacy area, in your opinion?
The big problem for our diplomats is that most of our diplomatic presence abroad is not our diplomats. The big embassies that we have all over the world are between a half and 90% manned by domestic agencies of the U.S. government, the State Department services, but that aren't actually conducting the essential diplomatic and consular work of the United States. Now, some of them are nevertheless very necessary.
Could you explain that to me a little bit more? What exactly does that mean?
That there are domestic agencies presences
abroad. So how
does
that?
Well, just to give you an example, I was deputy chief of mission of the embassy in Rome. There were 36 different agencies of the United States government stationed there, and I calculated that well over 90% of the presence there was due to non-State Department agencies. That is, it was there. It might be helpful and supportive in our diplomatic work, but it was not the heart of our diplomatic presence, and we could have done without a great deal of it.
So why does it work that way? Why does the State Department have these?
I think there are two reasons, basically. One is legacy. When you win World War II and you have to occupy Western Europe and institute a Marshall Plan for rebuilding, you end up with some very, very large embassies, as we did also after the war in Baghdad, and we will also after as we withdraw from Kabul. And so there's a legacy aspect to our very large presences abroad, but there's also inertia. And it is just a whole lot more difficult to end a presence abroad than it is to start one. And that has to change. The State Department has to get much better control over presence abroad and be much more parsimonious about it.
So does this mean that we're in some locations where it would have made sense, you know, say in the 50s, but it doesn't make as much sense now, and there are other parts of the world where we should be that we aren't?
That's exactly right. Our secretaries of state have tried very hard to move our diplomats, and it's proven extraordinarily difficult. Much brighter people than I am have tried to redesign the State Department over the last 30 years, and they're not succeeding. And I think they're not succeeding largely because they're starting with the existing model of bilateral embassies and a whole diplomatic structure that's organized as a static presence abroad. And what we need is a much more agile, much more mobile presence abroad, one that can move from place to place as we require it, but that will fold its tent as quickly as it will set up its tent.
Oh, so basically right now it could be one of those cases where we have a lot of people in one part of the world when we really should have a lot of people in another part of the world then.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, my embassy in Rome will be the first candidate, so far as I'm concerned. We needed many fewer people there. I'm not the first person in charge of that embassy to come to that conclusion. And we need many more people in some very difficult places. And we may not need them to be in big static embassies. They may need to be much more agile and mobile, as journalists are, as some of the private organizations that do reporting from overseas are.
Maybe in the way that the military is.
Also the way the military is, and I'd like to see our diplomats training and deploying with our military forces rather than trying to gin them up to do that 2 weeks before they go abroad.
So why doesn't that happen again? You said there's some bureaucracy involved, but are there other reasons?
I think there's legacy and inertia involved and a commitment to a static presence that just no longer suits the world. We need to be able to move our diplomats very quickly, very agilely from one place to another, and they need to be ready and willing to do that. And that's a tall order. I mean, you've got to understand what I'm suggesting is making life very difficult for our diplomats, not easier.
Okay. So there could be some diplomats who would like to stay in a place like Rome rather than going somewhere else.
Oh, there definitely will be. But the fact is that we need them where we need them, and the country has to be able to make those kinds of decisions and to enforce them effectively. That's proven very difficult with the current setup.
Well, we're going to talk more about this in a little bit, a complicated issue, but we'll talk about the whole range of that with Daniel Serwer, a Middle East scholar who thinks the U.S. should focus more on diplomacy rather than the military.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. Do you think the United States should emphasize diplomacy over military might? And do you think the United States should think about focusing less overseas and more on its own shores? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're here with Daniel Serwer, Middle East Institute scholar, talking about his book, Writing the Balance, How You Can Help Protect America, and Increasing Use of Diplomacy Over Use of the Military.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you think that the United States should put more emphasis on diplomacy over the military? Do you think the United States should stop worrying about problems overseas altogether? Well, give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And we do have quite a few calls. Dr. or Professor Serwer, I'd like to just touch in with you and make sure I'm understanding what you're saying here. Basically, you're suggesting that the diplomatic forces in the United States should be as mobile as the military and they should be used more. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yes.
Absolutely.
They should be mobile and agile, ready to go where we need them, when we need them. And we should have a core of people prepared to do that and stop stationing quite so many in fixed embassies abroad where they mostly service the domestic agencies of the U.S. government rather than doing the diplomatic work of the United States.
And that's primarily talking about the State Department activity. And then there's also USAID, which is different, or is that part of the State Department? Help me out with that.
Well, you'll have to ask them whether they're part of the State Department or not. Nobody has ever quite determined that. The fact of the matter is I think we can't afford two separate organizations any longer. They are quite a separate bureaucracy, even if they report through the Secretary of State. And I think that's wasteful, and I don't see any reason for it any longer.
Well, we have a number of people on the line, so we'll just start going to the phone calls, if that's okay with you. Dan from Escanaba, Michigan, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks. You've got a great program. Wisconsin Public Radio is so wonderful. I'd just like to, a comment and a question. And I would agree with your guest. And I had run into a military officer in an airport and had a very good conversation. And he had said at the time that, I said, well, how many Pashtun speakers do you have in Afghanistan? And he said, I think there's six, you know, who are actually soldiers in the U.S. military forces, and that is just an absurdity. I agree, you know, that we need more diplomacy. We need to learn other languages and to avoid war. And my question is really, I guess, goes back to Dwight Eisenhower, who warned us of the growing political influence of the military-industrial complex and the profits of war profiteers and their influence over our political process. And I'm wondering, from your point of view, how much is that a role? Is it because the people lobbying Congress don't want peace? They don't want negotiated settlements like in Iran because there's billions of dollars to be made by Lockheed Martin, Martin Marietta, and these other war profiteers? I'd like to I'll take your answer off the air.
Thanks, Dan. A couple of good questions there. Daniel Serwer, you want to respond to that?
In my experience, we don't go to war because some company wants us to go to war. We go to war over vital American national interests, and I don't think that's the problem. I do think that the companies have a great deal of influence when it comes to the Pentagon budget, and that one of the reasons for the really quite spectacular growth of the Pentagon budget in the last 10 years has been very effective lobbying on the part of the companies. Now, mind you, there was a threat to me. The attack on 9/11 led to a vast increase in our military response, and a lot of mistakes and some good things that have been put in place. But the companies, in my view, don't lobby to go to war. What they do is lobby to increase the Pentagon budget.
What about the point that Dan, or the question Dan made about the number of people who can speak different languages and stuff in the State Department? Is that an issue?
It's a big issue. We are in bad shape in this respect, and the rest of the world is in much better shape because it's sending thousands of students to the United States. The Iraqi government alone is sending over 1,000 government officials per year to the United States for advanced education. We are going abroad less. We are not learning hard languages at anywhere near the rate that's required. Now, this is a little complicated. Study of hard languages is increasing in the United States.
When you say hard, do you mean the difficult languages?
I mean difficult languages.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean not French or Italian or Portuguese, the ones I speak, but the really tough ones. And the study of hard languages is increasing fairly rapidly, but from a very, very small base. So we are nowhere near meeting the need for these hard languages. And the rest of the world is much farther advanced in meeting their need to learn English.
Well, we're talking about the imbalance between military and diplomacy with Daniel Serwer. He's a Middle East Institute scholar and professor at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Brian from Green Bay, thanks for joining us on Central Time. Brian?
I'd like to ask the professor what he thinks of the Peace Corps. I kind of think that's what Sergeant Shriver and President Kennedy were trying to do with that. And just how is the budget of the Peace Corps? The last time I looked, it was minuscule compared to anything else we do for foreign relationships.
Brian, thanks for that call. The Peace Corps, how does that fit into our diplomatic efforts?
I think it's very much part of the diplomatic armatorium, if I can call it that, the diplomatic.
You said
tools
diplomatic armatorium.
Available. The diplomatic tools we have available. Peace Corps is one of those tools. It's not gigantic, but it is very, very useful in relatively permissive environments where there are no active hostilities ongoing, and where the host government welcomes the Peace Corps volunteers. But it's only a piece of a much broader picture of voluntarism and charitable giving abroad. You know, America sends an enormous quantity of money abroad, either as investment or as what are called remittances, money sent home by workers who've come to the United States. And that money has become an extremely important part of financial flows to very poor countries. And so we have a whole lot of tools, and this is part of my point in the book, that, even if you're sitting in your armchair in Oshkosh, you can actually give money, or invest money is more the better way to put it, in small enterprises in Malawi, for example. I've done it on a website called Kiva. There are many others that do it. There are opportunities for Americans to contribute civilian efforts that go far beyond the Peace Corps. Not that the Peace Corps is bad, but it is relatively small. And there are many other opportunities for civilians to contribute to development, to peace building abroad.
So what kind of reaction have you gotten to this? I know that some people thought you were going too far and throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Is that the case? Or?
Well, I don't want to be throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I think, I was motivated to make some fairly radical proposals for rebuilding the State Department, USAID, from the ground up, largely because I've seen for decades, much more moderate reform proposals come to nothing. And we've had four very able secretaries of state in a row now, each one of which has tried to, in one way or another, reform the State Department, though what John Kerry will do in that respect is not yet entirely clear. And they've largely failed. And they've largely failed, I think, because the system that exists is a very consolidated institutional system that needs radical reform and can't be done at the margins.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us about it today. Daniel Serwer is the Middle East Institute scholar and professor at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. You can read more about this. You can get his recent book, which is called Righting the Balance: How You Can Help Protect America. Thanks so much for joining us. It's Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Every year, holiday decorations at the Capitol include Christmas trees donated by a Wisconsinite. WPR's Brianne Chassau tells us more about the tradition and the man behind this year's tree.
In the center of the state capitol rotunda, a 25-foot balsam fir wears colored lights. Ornaments celebrating Wisconsin's traditions, this year's ornament theme, drip from the branches, paying homage to Friday night fish fries, dairy cows, and the Green Bay Packers. The balsam fir is itself a tradition. Since 1916, a treehouse stood in the rotunda for the holidays. Christmas trees are a big business in Wisconsin. The state ranks fifth in the nation for the number of trees harvested, nearly 2 million each year. This year's tree in the rotunda is a native of Anago, just like the man who donated it. Jim Drager has sold Christmas trees for almost 50 years and grows balsam and Fraser firs. The Frasers, though, are his favorite. This year, he was selected to donate 6 trees, 5 of which are at the state capitol. The 6th is at the governor's mansion.
That is probably Governor's Mansion is probably one of the prettiest trees I've ever seen, and very nice. And that was a Fraser. The only balsam was the one in the rotunda, and most people can't tell the difference. It's just that they were all grown in Wisconsin. The balsam are more of a native of Wisconsin, but you can't, unless you're in the business, you can't hardly tell the difference. They're just a little bit thicker and a little darker green.
Drager estimates he has between 20 and 30,000 trees at various stages of growth, and it takes about 10 years to grow the average Christmas tree. Most of Drager's trees end up in Anago and Rhinelander. However, his trees have traveled as far as Florida for holiday celebrations. Over the years, experience has taught Drager how to grow a Christmas tree. One thing that doesn't work, he says, are the animals. For some reason, deer love nibbling on the Fraser firs, but they don't touch the balsams. Over the years, Drager has tested ways to keep them away from his trees. One even involved leftover Christmas decorations.
One year right after Christmas, they were working on a patch of mine. The deer were. So I went to Walmart and bought some little Santa Claus, you know, those motion. And when you walk by him, like Santa Claus starts to wiggle. I said, oh, that'll work. Well, I bought a couple of them, 2 or 3 of them. They were on sale after Christmas. And I hooked them up with a battery. Put them out in the field. Boy, it looked like I was working good for about 2 weeks. We had the cameras out there. After about the 3rd week, the deer were licking Santa Claus's face. I said, but that isn't the answer.
Drager admits that growing trees is a lot of work. A crew helps with trimming and caring for the trees. But he likes it.
I like to see them grow, and I like to see them shape up nice and look good. And that's more of a enjoyment than anything.
As Drager and I drive to look at more trees on one of his Christmas tree plantations, I keep thinking about the ornaments hanging from the tree in the Capitol Rotunda. Going fishing, cheese, and Kringles, all of those Wisconsin traditions, and I can't help but think, what's his?
I guess the trees would be the big tradition. The trees and the buying the presents and the family get-togethers. I guess that would be the 3 biggest reasons.
So if you had to design an ornament to go on that tree, it would be a tree?
Probably.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council.
The tradition of Christmas trees in Wisconsin goes far beyond the tree in the Capitol. Wisconsin's northern Europeans were the ones who actually began the traditions of bringing live trees indoors for the holidays. And when it comes to growing those trees, Wisconsin does a pretty good job at it.
We're joined now by the co-owners of Schrader's Forever Green. Sue Schrader is with us. Her evergreen trees have won state and national competitions, and she's had the opportunity to present a Christmas tree to the people of the United States to place in the White House. Sue, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you as well. So where does the tradition of putting live evergreen trees in our houses for the holidays come from?
Well, from the research that we have found through the National Christmas Tree Association, the use of live evergreens as a symbol for the celebration of life started way back with the ancient Romans and Egyptians. And the practice has evolved over the centuries and has incorporated the celebration of Christmas when it came to the German areas or Germanic areas of Europe. And, of course, when those folks immigrated here to the United States, they brought their traditions with them.
And what kind of trees do we generally put in our homes?
Well, here in Wisconsin, and I can just speak, all over the United States, there are different trees that grow better locally. But here in Wisconsin, the balsam fir, the Fraser fir, and in the recent past, in the past 25 years, Scotch pine, white pine, and the different spruce trees were all very popular. Currently on our retail lot and at our wholesale location, balsam fir and Fraser fir are the two biggest sellers.
Yeah, that's interesting. I feel like when I was a kid, you didn't see Fraser firs, at least not many of them, and now there are lots that are dedicated to nothing but Fraser firs. What happened with the Fraser's rise in popularity?
Well, for one thing, they are not native to the state of Wisconsin. They are more native to the hills of North Carolina, from what I understand. But they became popular because they have a little bit heavier branch than the balsam fir does. They oftentimes will retain their needles just a little longer than the balsam fir. And you can they will hold a heavier ornament because those branches are a little heavier. So they're something that folks really like as far as putting a lot of decorations and things on them.
Is there a kind of tree that's the most fragrant if you really want that beautiful evergreen smell?
Well, actually, both the balsam fir and the Fraser fir have a lot of fragrance, and they are probably not the pine scent that you're thinking, but they are a very beautiful scent, and they're somewhat close in scent, but not exactly.
Now, you have won national competitions and provided the tree for the governor's mansion and the White House. What goes into growing a tree that's that good that it gets to sit in the White House?
Well, I'll tell you, a lot of labor, a lot of tender, loving care, and a lot of help from above. We do not have irrigation at our farms. Our farms are all irrigated from the rain and the snow we receive throughout the year. And so it's, there's a lot of things you need to learn to grow a good Christmas tree, just like to be a good farmer in any sort of crop. And I guess you also just have to have that little bit of luck and just, I don't know, we've been very lucky, and we think we produce some of the best trees that, can be produced.
So which White House was your Christmas tree in?
We won in 2011, so we presented it in November of 2011.
So that was,
of course, Michelle Obama accepted the tree on behalf of the people of the United States.
Well, yes. What was that like? Did you get to travel with the tree and see it off to its new home?
Well, we did not travel with the tree, but when the tree was harvested at our farm in central Wisconsin, it was put on a FedEx freight truck, or FedEx ground, excuse me, truck, and we said goodbye, and then we met up with it when it was brought on a horse-drawn carriage to the North Portico of the White House the day after Thanksgiving that year, and it was truly special.
So would you call Wisconsin a particularly good place to grow evergreen trees?
It is. It is a very good place to grow the varieties of Christmas trees that, we are known for. Like I said, we are now known for balsam fir and Fraser fir, and of course some of the pines. We have something that helps with their keepability. In other words, when we harvest them, we can harvest them and ship them across the United States, and they keep quite well because, generally speaking, we have a good killing frost before our harvest season. Our killing frost is generally in early October, and that helps with keeping the trees fresh after shipping.
In terms of the shape of the tree, I understand there's some pruning that goes on, and I wonder what sort of shape do you go for when you're pruning a tree to get a classic Christmas tree shape?
Well, honestly, over time, that has changed a little bit, too, at least in our operation. The obviously, the conical shape that everybody thinks of a Christmas tree, we have lots of different shapes and sizes out there now, but we have found in the last 10 or 15 years, folks are wanting, we're having a call for more narrow trees than we did a few years prior. That live in smaller spaces, you know, need just not quite as wide and full a tree. But in all honesty, I've retailed almost 40 years, and every shape and every size we have a request for.
Right. It used to be, I feel like in the past it did used to be those nice round fat trees that took up a lot of width, and now it is those narrow trees. So it's interesting that it goes in and out of fashion.
Well, that's just the way it is, isn't it?
I guess so. So what do you have in your house?
What I have in my house this year is a Fraser fir. It is 8 feet tall, and it is moderately wide. It's not the super widest one, and it's not a super narrow one. We're kind of right in the middle this year. And you can hear all the family members in the background now.
I hear some dogs.
Yeah.
So once you've got the tree in the stand, are there things that you can do to preserve its lifespan and the rate that it drops needles, or is it just sort of the breed of the tree?
Well, actually, it's kind of both, and it starts before you put the tree in the stand. You need to buy from a reputable retailer if you're buying it already cut. You need to be sure it's fresh. As we're speaking today, it's probably too late to be worrying about the test for freshness because most people have already got their tree. But you need to make a fresh cut right before you put that tree in the stand in the house. And then once that fresh cut has been made, it needs to be placed in a stand that holds quite a bit of water. Now, my tree just came in 2 days ago, and it has drank over a gallon of water every day. In fact,
thirsty.
I put another gallon in this afternoon. So a water-holding stand, and keep an eye on that stand, and that's the very most important thing. The other things you can do is, obviously, you don't add anything to that water. Contrary to all the rumors out there, you don't need aspirin or 7-Up or vodka or whatever. Just plain old water. That's what got it to where it is, and it's, you know, going to keep it fresh. And then, obviously, don't put it in front of a heat source like a heat register or a fireplace, someplace that would be drying and hot, because that's just kind of common sense.
And you mentioned a couple of tests for freshness when you're buying the tree. Now, it might be too late for a lot of people this season, but we'll think ahead to next year. What are some things that we should look out for?
Well, one thing you should take a look at, now this is in temperatures that aren't bitter, bitter cold, okay? If it's 3 degrees, it doesn't hold up. If the branch is pliable it doesn't snap off as a dry branch might, that is one good sign. If you gently pull your hand across the needles or across the branch and you don't end up with a handful of needles, that's a good sign. And again, taking just a look at it, and if it looks healthy and fresh, it probably is.
Sue, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, you're welcome.
We've been talking to Sue Schrader, co-owner of Schrader for Evergreens.
Next is the news from National Public Radio. Then we talk about the lasting popularity of the Christmas carol. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.